Because, you know, when I think of Jesus, he was the most inclusive man that ever walked this earth 2,000 years ago. He brought empathy, unconditional love, forgiveness, grace, no judgment. All those qualities that he brought was to build the self-esteem of the people he met, and that potential to see the person and what they can bring.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Life Well Lived podcast with me, Shane Breslin. I really, really enjoyed this conversation that I'm bringing to you today, and I hope that you enjoy it as much as I did. It's with a gentleman called Frank Diamond. I met Frank in Dublin shortly before Christmas 2018, and I think you will agree if you listen to this episode to the end, and I really, really hope and encourage that you do, that Frank has a very unique perspective on life. We talk about Frank's memories of growing up in County Derry in Northern Ireland during the Troubles, his calling to the priesthood and the years he spent as a missionary priest in Africa, where he contracted malaria 9 times. We chat through some of the effect that had on his health and well-being, and talk about the current chapter of his life as, in his own words, a father in the true sense of the word to 2 young daughters, Corinne and Alicia. Alicia was born with Down syndrome, 2 holes in her heart and a leaky valve, and underwent 8-hour open heart surgery. Frank's new life with his girls, including the way Alicia approached her health challenges, has, he says, taught him anew the meaning of humility and hope and unconditional love in the world. We chat a bit about spirituality in the context of a move away from organized religion, the meaning of ego, the 3 L's of love, and empowering leadership in the context of Frank's new career with Emmer Genetics, a company which aims to help individuals and teams achieve high performance through a deeper understanding of the role of nature and nurture in our own unique individual makeup. I felt really, really grateful for spending this hour with Frank Diamond, and I really hope you enjoy this conversation. As always, if you do, I would be very, very grateful if you could help me spread the word about the Life Well Lived podcast. The mission of this podcast is to play a small part in helping to heal unhappiness in the world. And I try to do that by talking to inspiring people each week about navigating the challenges of life, being our best selves in the world, and overall living a life well lived. So if that sounds like something you'd like to get into your ears on a regular basis, please do subscribe by searching for the Life Well Lived podcast with Shane Breslin in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like this podcast with Frank Diamond, do take a screenshot on your phone or your computer and share it out on your favorite social network, whether that's Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, or all of the above. Without further ado, on with this week's show and my conversation with Frank Diamond. Frank, it's really great to be here. I'm very, very privileged to be spending some time with you today. If you take us back to your childhood in Derry, I know you come from Derry and a very proud Derry man, but some readers might feel they know a certain amount about what a Derry childhood might be through the work of Seamus Heaney. I know that's my own story, reading like Midterm Break or Digging when I was in back in school, and those kind of strong, maybe quiet bonds, the rural family, the spiritual. Did you recognise that from your childhood in Derry when you were reading Seamus Heaney or anything like that? Or was you, what was the Diamond childhood like in Derry?
Yeah, that's a good question, Shane. Funny, Seamus Heaney actually was a neighbour of mine where I live now in Ballaghy. So we have great affiliations with Seamus, and all that he did, and his poetry certainly resonates with that area. So I'm the eldest of 6 in the family, in the Diamond family, and brought up on a farm, so farming background, which actually very blessed to have had, to be honest, because it kept me rooted in creation and a work ethic, and spending quality time with my dad and younger brothers, and being outdoors, and then a huge GA background in the South Derry area of Ballaghy and Laffey. And then going to school, went to school in Ballaghy, and being a child and born in the Troubles, I was born in 72, so it was a very real sense of always being aware of the situation with the Troubles. Ballaghy, wee bit of background there, would be 95% nationalist and Republican village, parish community, and it had one of the biggest RUC police stations in the north of Ireland there. At the time when I was growing up, two of the hunger strikers were from Blaye, Thomas Hughes and Francis McIlwee. And that 81 hunger strike time, even though I was 9 years of age, I still have memories of the funerals, the police, the helicopters, all of that around where our house was situated. Mm-hmm. Our house would have been raided a few times, as all practically the houses around our area was just, there was a lot of intimidation. And if you were Catholic background, nationalist background, you were a target, basically, with the police force, the British Army, and the UDR were in command at that time, the Ulster Defence Regiment. Mm. And they were very sectarian. Mm. So funny, Dominic McGlinchey from my NLA was from Blaye as well. So all of that was going on, and even going to football matches and playing GAA, you would have been stopped. There was a lot of checkpoints at the, when I was growing up, and once they saw your name and where you came from straight away, you would have been pulled in and harassed in many ways and kept there. One example, there was myself and three lads going to a match, and the UDR at the time soldier said, oh yeah, I see from your driving license, you guys are from Londonderry. And obviously that didn't sit well with us. Mm. So John, my friend, said, no, we're from Derry. And the guy, the soldier, says, no, Londonderry. And John said, no, Derry. And he says, pull in over there. So we had a pull in, and we got out, and they searched us, searched everyone, and they kept us there for 2 hours, thinking that John would say Londonderry, but John didn't, and we didn't. And but eventually, after 2 hours of that, they let us go, but we missed the game. So that type of stuff was going on, and then, you know, about Cross McLean and all the rest. Yeah. Blaye's GAA club rooms would have been burnt to the ground a few times. John Davey, then, from Lavey, Sinn Féin councillor, was murdered. Fergal McCusker was murdered from Glen Mahara. And then our own chairman then, Blaye, in 97, Sean Brown, was brutally murdered by lawless paramilitaries. So, yeah, growing up and even going to school, you'd have the British soldiers doing patrols in the street, and they would be pointing the gun because they knew by your uniform which school you went to. Mm. And they would have pointed the gun at you going up the street. So that would have been part and parcel of it, Shane. And it's funny, you know, people, I'm living now in the South, and I know that the media in many aspects would portray the situation in the North as a religious war. And that, my own personal view of that, that never was the case for me. It was always, because you were Catholic, right, and you went to Catholic school, I would be a nationalist, and you know, and that's how you would have been viewed. But the Protestant community, obviously, they're unionist and loyal to the crown, the queen, and all the rest, and that's how they would establish themselves. But for me, it was the Irish and British divide that was there. Yeah. It was never anything to do with religion. Great Protestant neighbour friends. When I was going to nightclubs back in the day, I had a courted, you know, Protestant girl, no problem. So for me, there was absolutely no problem with that religious end of it. And actually, Wolf Tone was a Protestant, you know, the founder and our club named after him. So anytime I hear that the Catholics and Protestants can't live together, it does irritate me and frustrates me, because that, for me, is not the case. It's the Irish and the British kind of relationship. For me, it was always that, you know, frustration and that discrimination and fighting for your equality and civil rights. For me, John Hume was the man. Mm. If somebody was to ask me, Frank, growing up and now, like the Good Friday Agreement, etc., 20 years ago, who was the main man? And without doubt, John Hume. I just think he was remarkable in every way. And I also have to say, Martin McGuinness played a big role as well from that continuum, you know.
And what was it about, so John Hume, fellow dairyman, right? What was it about Hume and his character or personality or leadership that that you felt played such an important part then, but even on a kind of a role model basis, that you might take from him?
I would say his humility, first of all, his listening skills, his respect for everyone, and empathetic nature of the man. And just, real gentleman and gentle approach. And I also think of actually Mo Mullen, the late Mo Mullen, Lord of Mercy on her. She was a tremendous advocate, and she would have had those qualities as well.
And they're human qualities more than anything else, right?
Yes.
It's like that doesn't go for any
tribe
or nationality. Like, you know, like you look around the world, that they're qualities you can find anywhere.
That's right. And it was never about John or Mo. It was all about the people.
Yeah.
And that was at the heart of it. And sadly now the situation there, you know, there's a lot of egos there and a lot of people who looking out for themselves, and you know, they're being stubborn in many ways and not inclusive.
Yeah.
That would be a thing. There's a lot of talk now of diversity and inclusiveness and companies that I'm working with on that. And they brought that in spades, but I just feel now, sadly, the Stormont situation and that's missing.
I'm from a completely different perspective. I'm familiar with some of the things you speak about in relation to the north. My dad is from West Donegal.
Mm-hmm.
We lived in County Meath, so several times a year when we were kids, we were driving from Meath to Donegal. And while a number of people that we know would have skirted around Northern Ireland and skirted around the border and driven through Sligo just to avoid mm-hmm. the border and the checkpoints, Dad was very firm in that the road is through Fermanagh, and that's the road I'm taking. So I would have seen up close the checkpoints and various things. I can't even really imagine what it was like to live in that. But in terms of what you experienced or went through, has there been any kind of like, what's the effect been of what your childhood and teenage years were in the Troubles, in the way things were? How have you brought that forward into your adult life, or what has the impact been on your adult life?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, we talk about diversity and that, and growing up in the north, you have that kind of religious diversity, the cultural diversity that's there, and that's very much a part of me, and I can speak to that, you know, when I meet folk. But just the progression now from where, when I was a young lad, and where it is now, is huge. I'm so thankful for that, especially the Good Friday Agreement 20 years ago, Shane. It was massive. And it was all about equality. Mm. And that's it. You know, it was nobody better than anyone else. But equality and respect and hearing each other's viewpoint and trying to work together around that, you know. And, the border, the checkpoints, all that now is gone, has been gone this last, you know, good number of years. And for me, actually, a lovely wee antidote or metaphor about living in Ballaghy, where that huge police station was built there just on the edge of the village, when the peace process came in and the Good Friday Agreement and all of that moved, that was knocked to the ground, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And Seamus Heaney now is buried up in Ballaghy. He was born there. And in place of where the police station was, there is now a 4.5 million Seamus Heaney centre on that site. And it's called Home Place. And every time I drive past there, it's just a beacon of hope, of peace, obviously. But we need kind of more justice, and we need to continue, you know, the journey. It's definitely stuck in there at the minute, but hopefully we'll get across the line. But
absolutely. It's interesting to hear you talking about Ballaghy. When I was growing up in Navan, one of my great friends was a scullion from Ballaghy. And their father had come from Ballaghy, and the lads, my friend and his younger brother had been born in Navan, but spoke with the strongest Derry accent because their mother and father are both from Ballaghy. Really interesting to hear that. When you went to college and you were playing Gaelic football, your maybe first kind of I'll let you talk about maybe your kind of your first experiences of a kind of it, maybe would it be fair to say your first achievements first experiences of kind of like, you know, success and achievement and where you could go in life might have come from GAA fields and various things with Lavi.
Yep, with Lavi, I had all my youth and underage football was with Lavi, and also my school was very much there, and I would have been fortunate enough at school level to have captained each team as we went through the each year and basketball as well, and fortunate enough to have been head boy. So that, you know, was definitely a confident builder for me. And then with Lave, I was the youngest in the squad that won the All-Ireland Senior Club back in 91. Mm-hmm. And with the Downies, the McGurks, and those lads, and the Scullions, funny, and I think I know the Scullion family you're talking about, you look to your friends with as well. So yeah, definitely, the GAA was a huge influencer. My father played for Antrim, and then he got seriously injured, had retired, then he took up refereeing, and he was chairman of Lave Club, and was always involved with the GAA. And just that kind of camaraderie, groundedness, team development, and just being involved with, and physical, obviously, it's very good for your own well-being with being physical activity, but it was the team and the friendships was huge for me at that stage, and continued to be then as I continued, you know, my footballing career. I had to retire now, but great friendships, yeah. And I continued then at university level, etc.
And so tell us about that. Tell us about where, because I know you've an amazing background and breadth of experience in Africa and further afield. Tell us a little bit about what your motivation was when you went to university.
Okay, well, I suppose I had a different calling. Well, everybody has their own calling. Mine was a wee bit unique in that when I was at 16, 17, I was seriously considering the priesthood, and that calling would have stemmed from RE was my favourite subject at school, and I was always intrigued by the carpenter's son, Jesus, and the life that he led, and the role that he played. And I also studied the missionaries, St. Patrick, St. Columbanus, St. Columbkill, and the likes, and St. Paul. And that whole missionary dynamic then, seed would have been planted. And I would have went to Drummondtown, the SMA Fathers would have ran summer camps there every year. And it's run by SMA priests back then and students for the priesthood.
And the SMA is?
Society of Missions to Africa.
Okay.
So as a young lad then, from the age of 10 to 17, I went to those camps a week every year. And that whole African seed would have been planted. And then I met these other priests and student priests, and they were very ordinary lads, down to earth, enjoyed the crack and had a few pints and enjoyed football and would have swore. And I had this image of Holy Joes, but they certainly weren't. So that kind of ordinariness struck a chord with me too, that you didn't need to be super holy to be a priest. And so that seed was planted. And I suppose at 17 and a half then, I was looking at where to go university-wise, what to do in my life. And I'm down at Port Clonoan Monastery, and there's a famous monk there called Father Martin, and he's an absolute legend, without doubt a walking saint. And I had a chat with him, and I was just sharing these feelings about possibly following Christ, joining the priesthood, etc. And he just said, Frank, he said, if Jesus was sitting beside you now, and he asked you just straight to you now, Frank, I want you to come follow me and be my missionary priest, how would you respond? I suppose, Shane, I immediately said yes. And that was the moment, you know, where divine intervention, the Holy Spirit, but I decided to try it out. And I came back then and I told my mum and dad and my siblings, and they were very supportive. And they said, Frank, you know, as long as you're happy, that's the main thing. And you're trying it, fair play to you. And then I was finishing up the A-levels at school, and then I told a few friends, and then after the A-levels finished, I let the word break. So it would have been big enough news back in that day, you know, that I would have been going to for the priesthood. Mm. And that's where the seeds would have been planted for that. And then I headed down to Cork. My first year, spiritual year, was in Cork. And then after that, I was kind of a year away from everything and no academia. And just learning more about Africa and the SMA and different things like that, and about yourself. Self-reflection and all the rest. And then I went to Maynooth and in 91 and did 6 years training for there with theology, degree in theology and in philosophy, and was able to continue the Gaelic football there and played Sigerson football. Was lucky enough to win an All-Ireland Freshers medal back then too. And then through all of that, then decided, was ordained, and then headed to Africa.
So where was your first port of call in Africa?
So first was Nigeria. So I went there for 4 years, and then I was home in Ireland and working in Ireland for a few years. And then I went to Zambia as a student, actually, for a year, and then Tanzania for three and a half years. In total working there.
And tell me a little about like the reality on the ground. Like we see, I guess 99.9% of us see Africa and the missions or the reality through the prism of a TV screen or a 30-second ad or an appeal for fundraising. Tell me a little about the reality on the ground when you arrived.
Well, whenever I got out there, Shane, I definitely experienced firsthand the missionaries, the work that they were involved in, both the religious and lay, and priests and sisters, very much so. And for me, they were the front line in international development. Because not only, obviously, our first role was to bring the good news of Christ and hope and all of that to the people, but we were involved with water projects, education programs, literacy programs, primary health care, equality for women, justice issues, especially for women as well, and all that frontline development, farming projects, teaching the people to empower themselves so they look after their own trainer. They call it like that famous quote where give a man a fish and you feed him for a day and teach a man to fish and you feed him for life. So that was very much the mindset of my day there and my experience of missionaries. And I know beforehand, like years before that, missionaries would have went out and had been a bit of, you know, handout and on that, but all that kind of mindset was changed, and that's very important to highlight that as well. Even back then in 98 when I first went out, that would have been the mindset, is to empower the people to take control of their lives themselves, you know, and teach them the skills to do it. And I loved that because it was transformative at a human level, and it gave the folk then we were working with confidence, self-esteem, belief in themselves, and just then that dignity that they weren't receiving handouts, that they were able then to feed their own family and grow their own foods and set up a wee business, cash crops and all of that, and irrigation water projects and sink wells. And that for me was very, very rewarding. And to see that in the front line was huge. Where I was based myself, it was always in very remote areas. The SMA charism would be primary evangelization, which is basically going out into the bush, remote areas where people have never heard of God, and bringing that good news and kind of planting seeds there. So I would have been set up with no electricity, no running water. The toilet was a pit latrine out the back. And then I was lucky enough to have four-wheel drive kind of Land Rover, because the size of the parish, for example, in Nigeria and in Tanzania would have been half the size of Ireland. And you'd have 100 villages, outstationed villages, to visit as best you could. And you'd go out there, and many of them could take you 3 hours to reach the village because there's just the roads are horrendous, some no roads at all. And then the people would welcome you, and they'd give you a tremendous welcome. And they would feed you the best of what they have. They would always kill a chicken for the missionary coming out. They would maybe only get chicken two or three times a year, but they would kill the chicken for the padre. And then we would have kind of catechism, mass, whatever, and then listen. And we'd usually stay out a night or two in some of these villages, which is definitely an amazing experience, sleeping in mud huts. But there was no electricity, so the big chief would light a fire in the middle of the village, and the community would gather around, and they'd bring out the goat skin and dog skin drums, because actually the Dakakari tribe in Nigeria, their main meat was dog meat. So the whole concept of hot dog took on a whole new meaning for me in Africa. I tasted it a couple of times now, but I wouldn't recommend it. So they would bring out and they would start singing and dancing around the campfire. And I'd bring out the guitar and would chance my arm at singing. I've never seen a guitar before. So I'm there and I'm teaching them. The first song I ever learnt, Shane, was Back Home in Derry, written by Bobby Sands, actually, when he was in H Block. Yep. And Christy Moore then put it to music. So that was the first song. So I have all these wee African kids and they're all singing, oh, I wish I was back home in Derry. Not having a clue where Derry is. But you know, and are they happy? Mm-hmm. And they were the happiest people that I have met, Shane, and they have nothing materialistically. Mm-hmm. And at night time, because it's so dark and all the rest, all you can see is their white teeth smiling up at you. And I am so white, I was like a walking torch. The rays were coming out of my face. But I often think back to those times, you know, and the stars at night in Africa, you can really reach, pick them from the sky, or you feel so close to them. And that just simplicity of that life there and the happiness of the folk, you know, and the children in particular having nothing will always, always remain with me. You know, I'll definitely always carry that.
Yeah. You know? So you mentioned there in terms of like the evangelizing mission and bringing the word of Christ or the message of Christ to people who had maybe who the word Jesus Christ might not mean anything. What's your own like? What does God mean to you? If that's not too big a question.
Yeah. It's a great question, and you know, when I think everybody, when I think of God. I used to do some retreat work in schools and get people to think about their image of God. How would they draw God? And some of them, amazing, you know, feedbacks from that. Somebody, they drew a can of Red Bull because God gives you wings. I know my own kind of image that I drew when I was a young lad, and it would always still remain, would be of a cuddly Care Bear, right? And on the Care Bear, there's a huge heart. Because God is love, and on the heart would say, love bears all things, right? And when I think of God, God is love, in John's Gospel, one of the second shortest sentence in the Bible, God is love, God bears all things. And that image, I go to God, or Jesus, think of Jesus as the human side of that, and any worries, concerns, challenges, all of that, I know I have someone there where you can go to and receive a bear hug. And just that image of receiving a bear hug can take away all kind of, you know, challenges and sufferings that are going on and help you get through it to know you're not alone. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, for me, it's that idea of, like, I don't know what's out there, but I do have a faith and a hope that there is something, there has to be, because of when I seen the suffering I saw in Africa and the world we live in, there's so much, oh God, negativity and poverty and suffering and death, all of that, Shane, there has to be another life beyond here for all those going through so much suffering. And we all have our own suffering, you know, and we all have our own kind of cross to carry and all of that. And I just, when I think of Jesus and the suffering that he went through, the crucifixion and all the rest, but yeah, and through his resurrection, there's that hope of a life after this world here now. And I do believe that. And that's, for me, now it's the spiritual journey I look at. And when I talk to folk, I don't talk about church or, you know, or that. I just ask them, you know, I think everyone has their own path, their own spirituality, and where they find a higher power to help them, you know, get through this journey. That to know we're not alone.
Absolutely, yeah. No, it's powerful. It's powerful stuff. And what's your own, like, we'll come back to it, because I know you had your own health challenges that arose from your time in Africa. We can talk a little bit about those in a second. But in terms of where religion is now, organized religion, it feels like there's a huge kind of movement. Maybe it's just something I've become aware of, but it feels like there's a movement towards meaning and spirituality. At the same time as there's maybe a movement away from organized religion. What are your own thoughts on kind of the way organized religion is?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the organized religion, as far as kind of church and institute goes, there is a move away from that with all the mistakes and the pain points and things that happened within the church and that institute. There's kind of a cleansing now, more than anything else, which is very positive and so needed, you know. And definitely people now, it's all about their own spiritual journey. And I think the church, and I suppose I'm speaking of the Catholic Church in my own respect, they lost touch with the people. So they did, and there was an ego there, there was a power, there was a control, there was a pedestal, you know, that's gone, thank God. Needs to be more gone. You know, it's still a work in progress when I think of the Vatican and the situation, you know, hierarchical structure and all is there. Because it's I mean, church is about the people. And I mean, I became a priest back in the day to serve others, a call to serve. And in many respects now, we're all called to that by virtue of our own baptism and whatever faith and church institute we follow or formal religion. It's that call to serve others and reach out and connect and support and build community. And that's where we're at now. And even last night on RTE, there was a brilliant documentary on Father Tony Coote, who's a priest suffering from motor neurons disease. Be a great man for your podcast. Amazing man. And I was listening to him and his, you know, his humility and his inspiration. And he was talking about the church too, that, you know, that had lost the run on themselves and all of that. But it has to build back up from grassroots level. And that's the people and the ordinary folk, you know. And that's, and there's so much goodness still out there, just needs to be tapped in, into, and they need to let go of some of the, you know, institutional ideas and that.
If we return a little bit to Africa, I read that you, I'm not sure what the correct word is, but you contracted or you had malaria multiple times. Tell me a little bit about what the impact of that was.
It's funny, when I first went out in 98, I was on, as you know, malaria is still the number one killer disease in Africa. There is no vaccine. Millions die every year from it, which, you know, is scandalous on many levels. And I know, I don't know, but I just have this gut feeling in my heart that if malaria was affecting this side of the world and people were dying so much from it, I don't know, I just think pharmaceuticals and things, there could be a vaccine. There is prophylactics, but that's a huge money racket there too, Shane. But anyway, I'll not go into that. But I was on the prophylactics. But if you're going to be out in Africa a long period of time, the chances of you contracting it from the mosquito is very high. And I did. It's a female mosquito is the carrier. And you get infected. It's a parasite. So they bite you, suck out your blood, and then would inject the parasite into your bloodstream. So that happened to me. And then my malaria became chloroquine resistant. Chloroquine was given as a treatment, but mine was chloroquine resistant. So every time I got the malaria in Tanzania, then I had to go on the last resort, which is the quinine drip. And basically it's a 4-hour quinine drip going through my system. And then I wait 4 hours afterwards and then get another 4-hour drip. Because if you did it back to back, you'd die because of the quinine is a very, very powerful medication going through your system. So I got it 9 times in all of my time in Africa, and I got very, very severe, and basically had to come home due to the severity of the ill health.
Oh, how does it affect? What was the day-to-day were you completely laid back or laid up or what?
When you get it, it starts off like severe fever symptoms. You know, you've the sweating and shivers at the same time. Headaches and nauseous as well, and sometimes the back door. So sometimes if you get to it all, you don't know whether it's coming out the front or coming out the back. But if it's not treated, then it very rapidly moves to the brain and cerebral malaria, and then from that it's usually lights out. I mean, it was very funny. One of our missionary priests there, elderly man, he actually, bless him, he was a bit of an alcoholic. He was out in the bush for 3 years on his own, and that kind of can happen. But he was a firm believer in gin and tonic, drinking gin and tonic. So he said, no, Frank, I'm not an alcoholic, because in tonic water and gin, you have the quinine. So he says when he was taking his gin and tonic at night, no, this is actually medicinal, Frank, is to keep away the malaria. So I actually didn't drink back then at all. That was it. But yeah, so that's how it contracts then. And I thank God, touch wood now, I've never got it since I came home, because the parasite is still in my bloodstream. Okay. I can never give blood, unfortunately, which is something I would really like to have been able to do, because it's a wonderful thing to give back, is to give blood. But I can't do that. But sadly, I would have buried many little babies, adults, people who died from malaria. You know, when they were buried in cardboard boxes, little babies in the middle of just the burial ground. Break your heart when you know. So we'd have been involved with supplying mosquito nets and also then some of the treatment and the medication when you do get malaria, because it only would have cost the actual nets were $4 and the treatment was $3, and yet it's still the number one killer disease in Africa, so we would have been involved with helping with primary health care around all of that and vaccinations against polio, things like that.
It's fascinating stuff. In relation to the last time you contracted malaria, I think that am I right in saying that that kind of coincided with your decision to leave the priesthood? Tell us a little bit kind of what was going through your mind then.
There was definitely a connection there. So I came home in 2011, sick in that, and I suppose then with the chance of going back to Africa, it wasn't really on the radar because of the health. And I was recuperating. And there was a kind of bit of soul searching going on, because I was the last kind of to join the SMA. There was one other lad, and the kind of the average age now would be about 120 within the order. And I was looking at kind of 10 years and that down the line, and it just looked a kind of very lonely setup. And I felt God was moving me a wee bit in a different direction. So after obviously a long period of discernment and reflection and prayer, I exited from the ministry, from the priesthood, and I started to look for a job then. And I got a job with a charity in England called CAFOD, Christian Aid for Overseas Development, who would be the equivalent to TROCRA here in Ireland. So it was a good fit, international development, etc., and continuing that work. And I met a very nice girl from Kildare. So I started to do the overseas romantic commute. And basically, after 6-7 months, I just said, you know what, if this is going to work now, I need to get the finger out. And so I moved over. And and after 7 months, we got engaged. And then after 6 months, we got married. And God blessed us straight away. We got civilly married. And God blessed us straight away with two little girls. Karina's 4 now and Leisha is 3, so as I say, I'm a father in the real sense of the word now, Shane, and you know what, it's the best thing ever. It really is now.
How has it changed your life, that experience?
The whole exiting obviously was a huge decision and all of that, and being a father now is just like, if I hadn't have made that decision, my two little girls wouldn't be here, and I wouldn't have met Jen. And it's just, when I look at them now, they are my life, and I do everything to support them in every way we can. And Leisha, who's 3, she actually, we had quite the journey with her health reasons when Jen was 27 weeks, and they went up for the scan in the coom. They noticed fluid around the baby's womb. Lungs and heart, and a regular heartbeat, so there was concerns. So basically, Jen was admitted, and she was kept in for 10 weeks in the coom, and constantly monitored, etc. They thought they might have to do an operation. They thought they may have to do an early section, all of that because of this fluid and all the rest. And then we were told, because of the heart, that it could be a 1 in 3 chance that the baby would have Down syndrome. But that wasn't an issue for us, Shane. The only issue was the health of the baby in the womb. So got to 37 weeks, thank God, and then they had all hands on deck for the section, the team ready to operate straight away to drain this fluid and all the rest. So section was done, and the next thing, the fluid drained away itself. Mm-hmm. So the whole team that was ready to do the operation, we didn't have to do it, which was amazing, right? And I knew straight away when I saw little Leisha that she had Down syndrome. They do a test then afterwards to confirm it, but I just knew. And it's funny, in my gut, before she was born, I had that feeling as well. So then she was in ICU for not long, thank God, and then tube fed and all the rest, but thankfully, everything progressed very well, but she did 2 holes in her heart and a leaking valve, which were going to need surgery, open heart surgery. So she was constantly monitored. We got her home and all the rest, and then I stayed at home for 2 years, minding the two girls because of the health issues and all the rest, and especially with Leisha. And then 2 years ago, Leisha was one, and we were called for 8-hour open heart surgery in Crumlin under the amazing care of Dr. Mark Redmond and his team, and Dr. Arda Franklin in Crumlin. So went through all of that, and you can imagine when you hand over, you know, your little one for that, and they tell you all the things that could happen. Worst case scenario, obviously, they tell you all that. I think I still get a bit emotional thinking about it, and the fear of all of what could happen. You just hand your little one over in hope and faith that all will be well, and we'd half the country praying for and all the rest. And we went down into the church in the hospital, the oratory, and just you fall on your knees when you're that helpless and powerless. The last, who do you turn to? And it's the man above, or your higher power, whoever that may be for you. And that was it. And thank God, came through that, and we got up. And it's funny, Shane, that was a tough challenge, obviously, for us. But when we met other parents and we saw other babies who were in that ICU unit afterwards, worse off, I mean, their hearts were still open. And all, and one of the wee babies, actually, she sadly passed, and her name was Hope. And just break your heart, but there's always somebody definitely, you know, worse off than that. And it just keeps you grounded in that, you know, you're mindful of them. You have your own stuff, and obviously it is challenged, but you keep everybody, and it's that thing of connecting with others and support network there. And we're still in contact with the parents that we met. Alicia was in, she was supposed to be in for 3 weeks recuperating, but we got her home after seven days, which was 8 days, sorry. So it was amazing, and thank God now, touch wood, she's doing fantastic. And she continues to teach all of us humility, unconditional love, inclusiveness, resilience in spades, you know, because her muscle tone, like, she gets to reach the milestones in her own time. It takes a bit longer, but she gets there. Like walking now, she's running around now, just since January, February, the walk in progress, but she's doing great now. And speech, obviously, speech and language, it goes through that, and physio and all the rest, and hospital appointments. But she said her first word in February, which was nice. Nice, that was her first word, which was a lovely word when you think of it, you know, because I always relate nice to being kind, and to be kind to each other is just, you know, what we're all called to do. And she can now say mama and dad, and she can say Frank, and it sounds like this, quack. That is Frank Sheehan, and every time I come home from work on it, she's there, he goes, quack, quack. And comes over with a huge hug. And just whatever hardship, you know, challenges at work and things like that, that hug for me in the moment, she's taught me mindfulness and living in the present moment. Mm-hmm. And that's what they do. You know, children with Down syndrome and other additional needs, they have such a gift. And I know there's different levels of, you know, Down syndrome, and some are extreme and they have other, you know, complexities and additional needs. We're blessed in that. Leisha is definitely mild and doing well, but everywhere she goes, she brings that ray of unconditional love and hope to everyone she meets.
It's amazing. It's lovely to hear you talking about that. And I think I'm a great believer in when we experience challenges, or if we have the breadth of the problem we have facing us is something that doesn't relate to the health of our loved ones, I believe we should be thankful for all the challenges that are, because they pale into insignificance, I think, when big things happen.
And
I was reading on your LinkedIn profile, it says that your principal motivation in life has always been to help people fulfill their true potential, to help build their self-esteem and knowledge of themselves in order to be happier, more satisfied, and more productive in life. That kind of maybe takes me on to what you're doing now and the company you're working for now, Emory Genetics. I think it might be fair to say, but tell me a little bit about that motivation you have about helping people fulfill their potential.
And that has always been kind of at the heart of Frank Diamond. That's why I became a priest, and obviously connected to Christ and the good news with that. Because, you know, when I think of Jesus, and I don't worry, I'll come back to it, but he was the most inclusive man that ever walked this earth 2,000 years ago. He brought empathy, unconditional love, forgiveness, grace, no judgment. All those qualities that he brought was to build the self-esteem of the people he met, and that potential to see the person and what they can bring and to the world, and that gift to bring to the world. And that now, that's how I got this job, is another interesting story, Shane. So for two and a half years, I was minding the girls, then Leisha had the surgery and I was able to look for a job. Now, as a former priest, you can be stereotyped and, believe it or not, labelled, and also prejudice and bias with all that has went on, you know, you know, with things within the church. So I was wondering, you know, what am I going to do, whatever. So I put on Facebook, I'm a believer, like yourself, Shane, and positivity, and putting it out there and just seeing where it may go. That was one of the reasons why I agreed to do the podcast, because you never know. I was quite nervous, and this is all new to me in this respect. But I put on Facebook, you know, after minding the girls, and I'm now looking for a job if anybody knows anybody. Lo and behold, Sinead Devlin from Mahara in County Derry, a girl I went to school with in St Mary's Maharfelt for 7 years. We were in the same class. She saw it, and she invited me to come up to Dublin and meet her for coffee. So I came up, and she told me about Emergenetics, and she basically offered me the job with Emergenetics. And it's all about personal and team development, building people their own potential in how they think and behave, and working with teams, and how high-performing teams can collaborate, communicate, and work more efficiently together. And that's what we're involved in. And it's a lovely fit, because it's a continuum of a call to serve others with a very positive tool, program, and it's all looking at the gift of the person and the gift to bring to the team, and that whole collaborative piece. And it's now we're new to Ireland. We're only here 2 years. It's a US company in Denver. So it's like everyone else is trying to get your name out there and your brand and plant seeds, etc., which is kind of my role with connecting folk and all of that. And I do some of the coaching as that as well. But once we do get in the door then, and we get to work with the team, you see the benefits of it. And it's just powerful. And I, you know, obviously when I see that, that gives me great satisfaction from the work I'm involved in now.
Amazing.
And where it may lead.
Yeah,
who knows?
Yeah, yeah. And personal development or professional development is something that I confess that I treated with ridiculous level of skepticism for a long time, in terms of like I felt I had a very fixed mindset for, like, you know, 20 plus years when I was. You mentioned a second ago about me being and the two of us having a sense of positivity. That definitely wasn't me for a long, long time. I think I'm kind of learning that now and trying to improve in that direction. But in terms of the way workplaces work and the way we get the best out of ourselves, both as individuals or in our jobs, our work takes up so much of our lives that it feels like to me that so many people are operating at, like, you know, 3%, 5%, 10% of their potential. Do you see, what are the hallmarks of a high-performing individual or leader, and also a high-performing team collaborating? What are the things that people need as individuals and teams to perform at a high level?
Yeah, well, I mean, for us, when we go in, obviously the first thing we say is you to invest in your people. Your colleagues, because once they're happy, everything will flow from that. Once they're content, for high performing teams, self knowledge is very important, and collaboration, and I think in leadership roles, empathy. Like, if you were to ask me, what's the key ingredient or tool at management level? It's empathy. It's to be able to get into the shoes of your colleague, and be with them and journey with them, whatever, you know, issue, whatever's coming up for them.
It's kind of something that you might hear in terms of, like, you know, you need to kind of build your empathy or to be more empathetic. How do you go about doing that?
Yeah,
I'm assuming that, like, when you talk about the development programs that Emergenetics have? Like, does that kind of does that help with that in some way?
It does. It ties in with it. We look at actually it's diversity of thought that we look at, how people think, and there's four thinking attributes: social, conceptual, structural, analytical, and how our preference, what our preferences in those thinking, and then with three behaviours as well that we look at. But I know for myself, my first preference in thinking is social, surprise, surprise. So that's all about the people, relationships, networking, wear your heart on your sleeve, empathy, intuitive about others, all of that. And I know that's what I do bring to the table with my team. And then my other colleagues would have different preferences. Sinead, for example, our MD here, her conceptual, she's thinking outside the box, creativity, innovation, all the rest. That's her brainchild to bring Emergenetics to Ireland and all of that. And then when you know your strengths, back to your point, and the gifts that your colleagues have and how they think, it's a huge advantage to have, because then you know how to speak with them, what language, how to connect. And again, from that knowledge, then that helps to be more empathetic, because you know you're relating to their preference and the strength and the gift to bring. And then you can link in with that and then bring it to the level at the team level. Yeah, and how you operate, working on your strengths.
And there's so much in terms of like the way workplaces work and office politics and kind of inner competitiveness and all that various things that can be kind of counterproductive to collaboration and high performance. Do you come across that much?
Well, that's a great question, Shane. And obviously, I've only been in the corporate world, the business sector, for 2 years, right? So it's huge difference for Frankie D, right? Oh, God, save us, it definitely is. It's such an eye-opener. And I know we all learn every day, but I'll tell you, Frankie D, this last 2 years is learning so much in this sector. It's incredible. And there's a huge need. There's a good friend of mine, Jerry Hussey. He'd be a great man for a podcast. You probably know Jerry. But he set up a company, Soul Space, and he's doing a lot of magical work in the corporate, and he's looking at igniting the human spirit. And I love that, because that's what we need now, very much in corporate and business levels, because, Shane, there's a lot of big egos out there. An ego, for me, I know we all have our own ego, but you have to keep it in check. You need to be mindful and step back a lot of the time and make sure that your ego is not trying to take over. It's the wolf that definitely can take over. And I remember coming across, I was involved with a 12-step program with counselling and that with alcoholics. An amazing program. But one of the things they talk about in the ego, and they refer that it means edge God out, right? And I know I'm going back to the spiritual a bit here now, but I've never forgot that. Because when you have a huge ego, it's all about me, yourself, and what you can get out of it. And you are forgetting community, others, etc. And we meet God in each other. And that's like edge God out. When you lose that spiritual dimension, human dimension of other people, and just think about yourself, it's detrimental. And, you know, it's big now. It's not big, but it is certainly present. And it's breaking that down. And even my own experience, Shane, which I'll share with you, I did lose my way with my ego as a priest part of the time, because I got caught up. I was very young. I played the guitar. I played Gaelic football. I had a bit of crack. I was, as a priest, down to earth, you know, and could connect with folk. And that was one gift that God blessed me with, is connecting with folk. So I was high profile, and people wanted Frankie D, Father Frankie D, for weddings, for funerals, for baptisms, for masses, whatever was going on, school retreats and all of that.
Popular.
Yeah. I let my ego feed into that. And in Africa, it was the same then with fundraising. Like when I came home then, people would have fundraisers and help and support. And I brought groups to Africa, all of that. But I lost Frank, and I lost my higher power, my relationship with him. And I didn't set aside time to look after my needs, self-care, and that's not being selfish. We all need to step back and look after ourselves. Mm. I burnt out, and I let the ego burn me out. I said yes to everything. I became a total people pleaser. Now, it's in my being anyway, but it overtook everything else. I forgot to say my own personal prayers, meditation, and spiritual direction. I let all that fall, and I burnt out. and then I just was no good to anybody. So I know about a wee bit about ego from that respect, and I always keep an eye on it now and try and be grounded and humility. I think it's one of the greatest gifts that in management and leadership levels, back to your question, and companies, humility is huge, and empathy and that.
Yeah. It's, I think my I've reflected a lot on ego, and I've come to believe from my own perspective, and that's the ego speaking there as well, but I've come to believe that my ego was almost like, you hear of ego and it's almost kind of like it goes hand in hand with big ego, like as in somebody with a big high opinion of themselves. My ego for a long time was at the complete opposite of that. It was like the low ego or the small ego, that I was thinking about myself and obsessed with myself from a position of low self-worth, like as in kind of projecting opinions onto me onto other people. So yeah, and when it comes to, it's interesting here to talk about ego. Like I try, it's a really, really hard thing to do, but I try to get rid of ego, both the big ego and the small ego. So yes. You can get rid of the whole ego.
We all have the ego, and that's part of our, I suppose it's part of our DNA, our personality, all that we do bring. But as you write, it's just the balance of where you keep it. It's neither high ego or low ego. It's that equilibrium, I suppose, you know. Yeah. And that is the challenge.
It is, absolutely.
Every day.
Every day. And you spoke there about your self-care and meditation. One of the questions I had, just a few more questions, we'll wrap up then shortly, but... do you have a routine? A routine of self-care, of spirituality, of physical. What do you have a routine, or is a routine important to you?
Yep, it is. Funny, I have a social preference. I also have a structural preference in the way I think. So that's putting a plan in place and a bit of process in that. I do my best with it. I know it could be better, but exercise. This morning I got up at 5:45 in Newbridge, commuted in to get into the gym and do an hour in the gym before work, get showered and get ready. That has helped me so much. I mean, all my life I've been a sportsman, and that has helped me with my own mental health and well-being. And that we all know how beneficial it is. It releases endorphins and all of that. So I try my best to keep that there. And walking, trying to get out for a walk if I can't get to the gym and that, because I don't get to the gym every day. Eat. I keep an eye on what I eat. Now, I have a sweet tooth. I love chocolate and ice cream. I am not a drinker, right? So alcohol is not an issue, but Bailey's coffee or Bailey's in milk, right, at Christmas time. Mm. Or believe it or not, Bailey's in porridge. I always get a bottle of Bailey's at Christmas time. And I have my porridge and it's like a dessert. So alcohol is not an issue. Sleep, I do keep an eye. I try to get the 7 hours as possible, you know, with sleep. Coming in on the Lewis then as well, I try to do a wee bit of mindfulness, even if it's 5-10 minutes. Now, I'm not great, it's a work in progress, to be honest. I know I need to read more. I know that's because, and again, it's back to me, I was always on the farm growing up or playing football. So I was always outdoors, Shane. So for me, that behaviour of reading wouldn't have been something, but I know it's very important and I need to just try and set aside. But when you have 2 wee ones and you get home and you're up and you're back home at 7, you're away from 6, you get a few hours with them. They're not early night sleepers. They go down about 10:30. So you want that by the time. And then at the weekends, you're full on, which is brilliant. Yeah. Love that. And connecting with a few friends then. It's gas in the office here. There's 5 of us. And there are 4 women and Frankie D. So the irony of my situation now, I was in an institute that was male-dominated at every level, right? I'm now married and I have 2 little girls, so everything's pink at home with Minnie Mouse and dolls and all the rest. And when I come into work, I'm blessed with woman again. So for me to connect with men like yourself, I have to lift the phone and call a friend. You know? But that's important because there's sometimes I have a few good close friends. I have a lot of, you know, I'm a connector, but I have a few close friends, and that's important. When I feel a wee bit down on myself, as we all do those shitty days, or sorry, but you know, those days, we all get them, I get them as well. Just phone up a friend and have a wee chat and offload.
Absolutely.
And just get it out of the headspace. Yeah. I you know, regrets and that, and the past, you know, for me, definitely, I have that, all of that, as we all do. It's funny, I have no regrets, But I think everybody does. You know, you do, you would make different decisions, right? But it's, you try and learn from the mistakes made, as we all do, and try not to make them again, you know? And the past is the past. And I very much now, and Leisha's taught me that, and mindfulness teaches me that, to try and live in the now. Mm. Tomorrow will take care of itself. And like I learned that in Africa from the Africans. They live in the moment as well, Shane, because tomorrow they don't know what could happen. They could get malaria, and life expectancy out there is so low. Death's just around the corner for many of them, so they live in the moment. And that's another thing I try to do, you know, is in that structure, is to keep focused and try and smell the flowers and be kind to folk that you meet and say hello.
Totally. I have two more short questions to finish up. What are you most excited about in life right now?
The two little girls and seeing how they continue to grow and develop and learn, and that's just magic. They are my excitement.
Final question. One of the things about this podcast that I'd like people to kind of think differently about happiness, to maybe I think there's a problem with the definition of happiness or what we see as happiness, and like the American Constitution says about the pursuit of happiness, and I think that's part of the problem, that we pursue happiness as opposed to recognizing that it's something within us that we can identify. Do you think about happiness, and what would your definition of happiness be?
Great question again. Am I totally happy? Honestly, probably not. What is total happiness? Like, coming up to Christmas, my dad died a year ago. You know, and the grieving process is there, so obviously there's no happiness in that, you know, and that's what I mean. But I think it's a state of mind within yourself every day. And that's what I've learned so far from my nearly 47 years in this life, that it's been happy to be with you now and sharing this, Shane, because first time doing it. It's happy to have a cup of coffee and a bit of chocolate, you know, to have that, to be able to have a job, to go to work. And it's funny, Jerry Duffy, another great guy, you probably know Jerry, brilliant, he wrote a couple of books, but I read one of his books and he and I are good friends now. And in the book, he says this kind of the mindset of I go to work, I go to play football, I go to this, but just change that to I get to go to work, I get to have a cup of coffee, I get to go to the gym, I get to go home to my two kids, and that struck a chord with me, and that ties in with happiness. I get to smile at somebody, I get to say hello and meet people. And I get to live healthily. Thank God, now touch wood. I get to walk. My senses, like after that show last night, I shed a few tears for Father Tony because I know where it's going to end. And I had a few friends who did pass away from motor neurons and all of that. But I get to walk, you know, and that was the title of his Walk When You Can, I think that was the name of it. So I get to do those things now. And it's that gratitude. Gratitude's linked with happiness for me. Just to be thankful to get up in the morning, that there. And I'll just finish with if somebody, you know, my wee quote I try to live by and remember when I have days that are tough, as we all do, is that it's the three L's. I am loved, lovable, and loving. And if that's what I want to end with, is for folk to remember those three L's from Frankie D. You're loved by so many others out there, and they mightn't say it to you, but there's at least 10 love you. You're loved, you're lovable as a human being, you're lovable, you're a gift from God, and you're loving. And then to share that, and that, when you have those three things there, there's happiness.
Frank Diamond, thank you very much for talking to me.
Shane, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Final word from me. Thank you so much for listening. I really, really hope that you enjoyed or got something out of that conversation. If you did, just let me know. Hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Shane Breslin on Twitter. And as I mentioned at the start, it would be fantastic to get any support that you can give to spreading the word about this podcast. If you enjoyed the conversation, please do take that screenshot and upload it to Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, whatever your social network of preference might be. If you feel there was anything in this conversation between me and Frank Diamond that you think that others could benefit from or could listen to. Thanks once more for spending time with the podcast today, and I'll be back here next week, next Tuesday, with another episode of the show. Thank you.